Parashat Shmini deals with two major topics. The first is Vayhi Bayom HaShmini, on the eighth day. It was the eighth day of the inauguration of the Mishkan, of the Tabernacle. It was the time that the Jewish people had been waiting for after all the preparation, after the months of collecting and building all the aspects of the Tabernacle. Finally, after certain sacrifices were offered, God's fire came down on the eighth day, accepted the offerings, and God's presence rested on the Tabernacle. The second aspect of this day had a more of a tragic note, and that was the death of the two sons of Aaron, of Nadav and Avihu, who offering a foreign fire were consumed by God on this day. The second aspect of the parsha is the laws of Kashrut. These are laws which the Torah itself tells us makes us into an Am Kadosh, a holy nation. I'd like to try to focus on two aspects of the beginning of the parsha. The first aspect that we need to deal with clearly is the death of the two sons of Aaron, of Nadav and Avihu. The text tells us that after the fire came down and the people cried out in joy, in happiness at this tremendous sight, so the Torah tells us that the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, each took his fire pan, they put fire in them and placed incense upon it, and they brought before Hashem an alien fire that he had not commanded them. And a fire came forth from before Hashem and consumed them, and they died before Hashem. Quite a number of issues that need to be understood in this particular story. Particularly, what is this strange alien fire that Nadav and Avihu brought, as well as our rabbis teach us that they learned from the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu, each took his fire pan, that the sons of Aaron, Nadav and Avihu did not consult their father Aaron, nor did they consult their uncle Moshe Rabbeinu before doing this. And the rabbis go on to explain that not only did they not consult Moshe or Aaron, but they did not even consult each other. From the phrase, each took his fire pan, that each one individually acted in this respect without even consulting each other. And this too needs to be further examined and understood. What is the lesson? What are the morals that we are to be taught about Nadav and Avihu? We also need to understand there are many midrashim that try to explain what exactly were the different sins of Nadav and Avihu. Among them, the rabbis note that Nadav and Avihu never married and never had children. And this too needs to be seen as part of the larger picture and understanding the personality of Nadav and Avihu. The second issue I'd like to deal with is found toward the beginning of the parsha. Parsha begins by telling us it was on the eighth day that Moshe summoned Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. And he said to Aaron, take yourself a young bull for a sin offering and a ram for an elevation offering, unblemished, and offer them before Hashem. So here we have Aaron being told exactly what offerings he needs to take in order to consecrate the tabernacle. And we continue in the next verse, in verse 3, and to the children of Israel speak as follows, take a he-goat for a sin offering, and a calf and a sheep in the first year, unblemished, for an elevating offering, and a bull and a ram for a peace offering to slaughter before Hashem, and a meal offering mixed with oil, for today Hashem appears to you. And in this particular selection, we need to ask two questions as well. The first is, what is the role of the elders of Israel? It would seem that Moshe summoning Aaron and his two sons, that makes sense, Aaron and his sons, because they are involved in the process of bringing the sacrifices. What were exactly the role of the elders of Israel? It doesn't seem that they have any particular function here. The sacrifices were taken from the entire congregation. The sons of Aaron and Aaron were the ones who sacrificed them. So what exactly is the necessity of underscoring here the placement of the elders of Israel? Further, there's a medrash that the Ramban quotes that needs to be understood. And it's really this medrash that's going to be the focus of our attention today. Shem Shmuel notes the following in the English translation. He says that the first part of the Sedra describes the final day of the inauguration ceremony of the Mishkan. After Aaron and the children of Israel had brought special offerings, he and Moshe blessed the people, and divine presence finally rested on the Mishkan. The Ramban notes something very interesting about these communal offerings. The Ramban here is quoting a Medrash. The Medrash says the following: why did the people have to bring more offerings than Aaron? Because he, God, had said to them, to the people, you have sin on your hands at the beginning and sin on your hands at the end. You have sins on your hands at the beginning of your nationhood, as the verse says, with reference to the sale of Yosef, and they slaughtered a male goat. Let them bring a male goat to atone for the incident of the male goat. And then they brought a sacrifice as well to atone for the Chet HaEgel, to atone for the sin of the golden calf. And Shem Shmuel notes that the he-goat brought by the people at the induction ceremony was to atone for the sale of Yosef many years before. But the Medrash needs to be understood. We can understand, and we'll have to develop this, of why the sacrifices at this particular time were to atone for the sin of the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf. Because as we've spoken about and we'll speak about, the sin of the golden calf and the tabernacle, one is really atonement for each other. That they sinned in misusing their spiritual strivings toward God, and God gave them a place and a form in order to express these religious yearnings. So it's understood why at this particular time they need to bring an offering to atone for the sin of the golden calf. But ask the Shem Shmuel as well as others, why is it necessary now to bring a sacrifice to atone for the sale of Yosef? The sale of Yosef happened hundreds of years before. There's really seemingly no correlation between the two. Why at this particular point is it so necessary that they bring a sacrifice to atone for that particular sin? And further asks the Ber Yosef of Yosef Salant another question. He says it would seem from this Medrash that the whole sin is really encapsulated in the fact that they slaughtered a male goat and they dip Yosef's coat in this goat in order to pretend that Yosef was eaten alive by an animal and not that they really had sold him. This is such a small aspect, really an ancillary aspect to the entire sale. Why is it this particular point that they killed this goat and they dipped Yosef's blood in this goat, that it seems that it was for this particular part of the sale that they now have to gain atonement by bringing this particular animal? So we need to understand a little bit more deeper what exactly was the sale of Yosef, what its connection is to the inauguration of the tabernacle, as well as the specific aspect of the dipping of the blood. Before we begin to examine this Medrash and what the Medrash teaches us, that the Jewish people have a sin at the beginning and a sin at the end, and they therefore have to bring more sacrifices in order to atone for the sin of Yosef as well as to atone for the sin of the golden calf, I'd like to pause for a moment and step back and try to explore the whole notion of what Medrash is about and the way Medrash plays such a key function in the whole understanding of Judaism. And I'd like to very briefly go through segments of Rabbi Feldman's essay, his introduction to this book, The Juggler and the King. And he notes that when the Torah was given to the Jewish people, along with the written Torah, which we call the Torah Shebichtav, or the five books of Moshe, came teachings which were meant to interpret and apply the Torah's written words. These teachings were meant to be orally transmitted throughout the generations, and this is what we call the Torah Sheba'al Peh, the oral tradition. And there are two distinct components of the oral Torah. There's halacha, as well as agadata. And the halacha is very clear. It's the easier of the two categories to define. It consists of the definitions, the sources, and the explanation of all the laws that govern Jewish behavior. The purview of agadata, on the other hand, is a Jewish world of ideas. Primarily, it deals with the principles of faith, the philosophy and the ethical ideals of Judaism. In addition, it includes all those interpretations of biblical verses and stories which are unrelated to halacha. And Rabbi Feldman notes that there's a tremendous difference in the way halacha and agadata are transmitted. While halacha is very much readily understood by everyone, and it's clearly delineated in the oral tradition, the agadata is presented in a much different light. It's much more obscure. In agadata, the message often, some of the most basic ideas of Judaism are garbed in what appear to be parables, riddles, or even practical advice without apparent religious content. And the reason Rabbi Feldman brings down, a very famous reason, is that originally the oral tradition was not supposed to be written down. It was supposed to be transmitted by word of mouth, and this was necessary in order that there be no room for misinterpretation. It's interesting that the whole Agadata section was only taught to very wise people who had the ability to absorb the messages found. And therefore, when the sages feared that the students' memories might no longer be counted upon to retain the vast wisdom of Torah, they decided to commit it to writing, a process which eventually led to the redaction of the entire oral Torah. But he goes on to explain that the sages' decision to commit the oral tradition to writing created no problem with respect to the laws of Jewish behavior, but with respect to the more abstruse concepts of Judaism, the sages found themselves in a dilemma. Unlike halakha, Jewish law, these concepts cannot be readily understood by everyone. Indeed, up until then, they'd only been taught to the wisest of the students of each generation. If they were now committed to writing and so made available to all, they'd be exposed to misunderstandings and distortions of untutored readers. On the other hand, if they were not written down, they might, as the sages feared, be lost forever. And therefore, the problem was solved by writing these down, as it were, in coded form. And the obscure form of parable and hint, these are keys to the true meaning, would continue to be transmitted orally. They were relatively few and ran no great risk of being forgotten. And that's why in looking at Medrash, we are never to understand Medrash on a literal level. When Medrash is written down, it's couched in terms of stories, of parables, of lessons, but there has to be understood and decoded a key of what the Medrash is trying to teach us. And likewise, in our case here, when we're speaking about here that the Jewish people had a sin at the beginning and the Jewish people had a sin at the end, and here we're dealing with the sale of Yosef, so what is being transmitted to us is lessons to be understood. It's not just a question of we're dealing here with a case of one animal mentioned in one place and one animal mentioned in the other, and let's connect the animals and this is really irrelevant to our lives. No. When Medrash is understood and Medrash is taught, it's meant to convey ideas, it's meant to convey lessons, and these lessons are conveyed orally from teacher to student as couched in these obscure and abstruse readings of the text. So the question that we need to understand here is, what is the Medrash trying to teach us? What does the Medrash mean that we need to gain atonement at the beginning and at the end? How does it connect with the inauguration of the tabernacle? How does it connect with the death of Nadav and Avihu? And clearly, what lessons is it trying to convey for our personal lives? So I'd like to try to understand this Medrash on two levels. One, on the level of the Ber Yosef, Rav Yosef Salant, and the second, on the level of the Shemi Shmuel, and a number of commentators fall within each of these commentators. The Ber Yosef notes the following. He says, if we try to examine the end of the Medrash, that we have a sin at the end, that we need to atone, and we therefore brought sacrifices at the time of the consecration of the tabernacle to atone for the sin of the Chet HaEgel, the sin of the golden calf. He says, what exactly was the core, the root of the sin of the golden calf? So explain to Rav Moshe, based on Ibn Ezra, the Ramban, the Kuzari, that their focus really was not, their intention was not to commit idolatry. But rather, their whole intention was to make a demut muchashi, to make some type of physical representation that God would be able to rest his presence there. And it was to this aspect that they were focusing all of their efforts, all of their work. And as the Kuzari, Behuda Levi, further develops, the problem became, ki ein ha'adam magia l'inyan ha'loki elo b'dvar ha'loki. The problem became is that when a person cannot reach this level of divine, the divine resting among them, unless so commanded by God. And that is why, over and over again, what is underscored in the building of the tabernacle is Moshe did exactly as God had said. They lack this aspect of doing that which God had wanted of them. But says the Be'er Yosef even deeper than that. What they also lacked was something much more basic. And that is, they lacked being able to seek advice from the Gedolei Hador, from the great leaders of the generation, to ask them what to do in this personal situation. They acted on their own accord. They acted out of their own desires without seeking advice. And we see this when Moshe Rabbeinu left. When he went up the mountain, he says, "Bnei Aaron v'Hur imachem, I'm leaving you Aaron and Hur as the leaders. Mi ba'al dvarim yigash aleihem. Anyone who has a difficulty should come to them." And what happened? We know the Medrash tells us that Hur tried to stop them from their intentions, was killed. And this says the Be'er Yosef, he says, Nimsa shebiglalze, because they didn't listen to Hur, and they forced Aaron's hand into doing this, and they refused to listen to the leaders at this particular time, shelohit chashbein im da'atam shel zkenim v'gdolei hador, l'chein ba'u lidei ha'chet ha'nara hazeh, v'zeh haya ikar v'sharash chatam. The source, the root, the major problem, the defect, so to speak, that the people had was they acted on their own accord without seeking advice from people much greater than them. The Be'er Yosef quotes a beautiful medrash where Rabbi Akiva says that the Jewish people are compared to a bird. And just like a bird does not fly without wings, so too the Jewish people cannot do anything without their wings, and their wings being their leaders. And as the Tam V'Das Rav Sternbach points out, such a clear insight. He says there's such a major difference between the way society in general, Western society, views elderly people and the way Judaism views elderly people. In most of the Western society, people give tremendous amount of respect to the young, to the bright, to the ones with potential, the ones who are going to create new technology and find new discoveries in science. And the elderly people, they're like a burden on society, you know. We have to deal with them, but these are not the people that we look to with respect. And Judaism is the exact opposite. It's the elders, it's the gedolim, it's the sages who have reached a certain point in life, and all of elderly people, who, if nothing else, have life experience to teach a person, these are the people that we respect. When an old person walks into a room, no matter who they are, we get up for them, we show them honor. Because the whole view of Judaism is that the elderly people have something to offer us. They have advice to give us. They have insights that we don't have. And this is particularly true of Gedolim, of great rabbis. That to go to a Rav, to ask a question, to be able to gain advice, is something so important to give us direction, to give us insight into our own lives. So often they have that added insight that we are missing in our own lives that give us a certain perspective and attune us in the right direction. A simple story to illustrate this idea, Rabbi Cohn brings down in his Maggid series. It's the story of a Kolo man who's sitting and learning, who went with his Lulav and Esrog to Rabbi Eisman, who was Gadol in Yushalayim, who used to be a big bucky in checking Lulav and Esrog. So when he went to the Rav and asked, is this, you know, Esrog okay? Is it, you know, kosher? So the Rav said to him, tell me, you know, what are you doing? He says, I'm learning in Kolo. He says, for the amount of money that you're making learning in Kolo, this Esrog is not for you. It's way too expensive. He said, you should go back, return the Esrog, buy a cheaper Esrog that's also kosher, and then take the rest of the money that you were going to spend on the Esrog and go buy your wife a beautiful outfit for Yontif. This is somebody who has a certain insight and is attuned to life. That for somebody on this level who doesn't have much money to spend, then don't spend the money on the Esrog. Spend the money on an Esrog that's kosher and nice, but also spend the money to make your wife happy for Yontif as well. This is an insight that older people, that wise people, the people who have the sense of Torah and what Torah wisdom is all about can give to other people. And this is so important within our lives, that decisions that we make, particularly major decisions that we make in our lives, that we're able to go to people and ask them advice, and to go to these rabbeim, to go to these rabbis and be able to hear Das Torah, to hear Torah wisdom that perhaps we ourselves are not attuned to give us direction in life. If we understand that the sin, going back to the Be'er Yosef, it's a sin of not listening to Aaron and Hur, of not seeking their advice, but rather acting on their own accord, so now we can understand why at this particular time, when we're trying to get atonement for this sin, that what is aroused as well is the earlier sin of our forefather, of the sons of Yaakov, who had the same difficulty as well. We know, rabbis explain, that why did the brothers want to kill Yosef? So they really believed they were acting up in Torah. They believed that they were acting correctly. They thought that perhaps just like Yitzchak had two children, Yaakov and Esav, and only Yaakov got the bracha, and Avram had two children, and only Yitzchak got the bracha, they really felt that Yosef was trying to speak negatively about them, to knock all them out of the picture, that he himself would be the continuation of the Jewish people. Because they believed he was a Rodev, someone who was trying to harm them, so they felt what they were doing was right. Although this may be true, what they refused to do, or what the Pagam is, says to Be'er Yosef, was they decided this based on their own mindset. They didn't go to Yaakov Avinu, they didn't go to Yitzchak Avinu, they didn't go to the Beis Din of Shem Ve'ever and say, look, this is our Shiloh, this is our question. The problem was, they did not go to greater people and ask their advice. They themselves decided that this was the judgment for Yosef. And here comes the key. In order to hide that which they did, in order to cover up this act, that's why they dipped the ketonet, they dipped the coat into blood. And they told their father, you know, a wild animal must have eaten them. The fact that they had to cover it up was the biggest indication and the biggest proof that they were trying to hide something from Yaakov Avinu, that they didn't ask his advice, that they weren't willing to hear the advice of someone much greater than them in wisdom and in Torah. And therefore, now when we bring to the tabernacle and we're trying to correct the faults of the Jewish people, So we have the fault at the beginning of time and the fault at the end of time, which is the same fault. It's the fault of making decisions on one's own and not listening and asking advice of greater people than themselves. What's the proper way to react? What's the proper behavior? In the times of the Chet HaEgel, they killed Chur. They refused to listen. They refused to ask their leaders. In the time of Yaakov Avinu, the sons themselves made a decision without seeking advice, without asking Yaakov Avinu what was the proper mode of conduct. And therefore, since it the root was the same exact root, now, at the time of the consecration of the tabernacle, when we're trying to correct the negative fault, it was therefore necessary to bring sacrifices to atone for both of these sins. And that's why it's not by accident that in the first verse of Zakenim, the elders are called to attention, as if to underscore the role of the elders, even though they're not told anything specific, even though they have no specific role here. But the fact that the elders are found here is a lesson to the people. This is time to listen to the greater people than yourselves. The elders have a tremendous place. With this in mind, we can now understand so clearly the aspect of Nadav and Avihu. Continues the Ber Moshe, that when there was this tremendous joy from the people at the time when the fire came down, that Nadav and Avihu responded with this joy. And they took their fires out of a real passion and love and a desire to get close to God. But what they refused to do was to ask Moshe Rabbeinu. Nadav and Avihu are reenacting the very problem that we're trying to correct here. Nadav and Avihu are acting based on their passions, based on their mindset. This is what we feel impassioned to do. This is, as Rav Hirsch points out, the two sons had apparently acted on impulse, in an outburst of enthusiasm. It was just this impassioned act of pride in being able to approach the altar that proved fatal to them. For joyful emotions may not be allowed to serve as a pretext for violating the order established by law. To add to change God's laws, evil and sincere feeling of doing good cannot be tolerated. And that's why the Chidush Arim points out, we stress in every bracha of Asher Kedishanu B'Mitzvosav V'Tzivanu, who sanctified us with his mitzvos and commanded us. So on the one hand, they did this with this passion and enthusiasm, and this was not what God wanted. But it's much deeper than that. It was not only a question, this is not what God wanted. It was a question of they did not ask their elders. They didn't ask Moshe and Aaron, is this the correct thing to do? And therefore, their punishment is so harsh on this day of such tremendous simcha, such tremendous joy, to teach the people this tremendous lesson. That you're here now to try to atone for the fact that you didn't ask your elders, that you didn't seek advice. And here, Nadav and Avihu are replaying that same fatal mistake. It cannot last. Nadav and Avihu were killed on the spot, a lesson for all the people on the importance of asking and seeking advice. I'd like to try to develop this idea of seeking advice one step deeper, because I think that this is, on the first level, the key lesson for us to learn for our lives. In Majesty a Man, Rav Chenoch Leibowitz, the Chavetz Chaim Rosh Yeshiva, points out, the Medrash says that it wasn't only that they didn't consult Moshe and Aaron, but they were also blamed because they did not consult each other. And he goes on to explain that Chazal, our rabbis, are showing us the power of asking advice. Even if two equals, such as Nadav and Avihu, who both feel the same way about a certain topic, talking over may cause them to change their minds. By discussing a matter, the concepts involved become clarified and the issues more precisely defined. Had Nadav and Avihu consulted each other, the ensuing discussions would have brought into question the halachic basis for the sacrifice and saved them from their fatal mistake. We should never hesitate to ask the advice and opinions of others. It is important to discuss our action with our peers, even if we already know that they agree with us. They can help us examine our actions with a critical eye, to sift through our hidden motivations and anticipate negative repercussions that were not previously evident. But he goes on to explain that, of course, asking advice is not an easy task. Our pride and ego resist the suggestion that we might actually be wrong in our opinions, and we certainly dislike the prospect of asking someone else to help us correct them. The situation is made more difficult if we feel that the other party is not any smarter than we are. And he quotes a beautiful idea. He says, a possible approach to ease the difficulty may be found in Pirkei Avos, where Ben Soma teaches us, who is a wise man, one who learns from all people. Now, Rabbeinu Yonah explains that one who truly loves wisdom will search all over for it, as if similarly, if wisdom is precious to us, we will ask anyone we can to help us learn more. If we want to do what is right, it will never be beneath us to consult with and learn from a fellow man. This is the attitude that we need to have. This is the passion that we need to have to really be able to ask others, to be able to clarify where we stand. This is the first major lesson that the Medrash is trying to teach us, that the sin of the golden calf, the sin of the sale of Yosef, had the same sin. It was a sin that Nadav and Avihu were caught up in. It was the sin of being involved in our own mindset, where we're so sure that we're correct, and we're so sure that this is the proper way to act, that by not consulting others, by not asking greater people than ourselves, we can come to fatal and tragic mistakes in life. Rav Wolfson and Emunat Yitecha develops this idea even further and connects it with the period of time that we're in now, Sfiras HaOmer, where we know that the students Rabbi Akiva died for not showing honor one to another. And explains Rav Wolfson the following. He says that aside from the mutual respect people have to have for each other, there has to be respect for one's teacher as well as to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, to God himself. And it goes on to explain that the respect that we need to have for teachers, for elders, is really an aspect of hachna. It's an aspect of humbling oneself. And that's why it's very difficult for some people. Why should I go to this rabbi? You know, what does he know? And it's difficult for a person to say, he can teach me a lot. He can show me a lot. I'm ready and I'm open to hear what he has to say. The model that he gives is, the only way that you're going to be able to pour from a bottle into a cup is if the cup is beneath the bottle. If you place the cup above the bottle, the cup will never be filled from the contents of the bottle. That's hachna. You have to put yourself beneath the bottle to be able to fill yourself up. And he explains so beautifully. He says, that's why in this particular time of Sfira, when we need to work on this aspect of showing respect and showing this aspect of humility, that what we read is Pirkei Avos, Ethics of the Fathers. What's the first lesson that we're taught in Ethics of the Fathers that was repeated over and over again? So the first Mishnah tells us that Moshe kibel Torah Mesina. Moshe received Torah from Mount Sinai. What does it mean to receive? It means to be nichnal mekabel. It means that you're a vessel, you're ready to receive. And the whole chapter continues that Rabbi so-and-so receives kibel from so-and-so. Because the whole aspect of Torah learning is to be able to receive. The whole aspect is to be able to be that cup underneath that bottle and say, you know what? I have what to learn. I'm ready. I'm open. I want this type of relationship. And this is the model of the angels, where we say in our davening, based on a verse, the Karazeh Elzeh, that the angels turn one to another. They are mekablim zemizeh. They accept one from another. Machniyim et atzmam al chavarehem. They're able to accept one from another in order to together be able to be karazel zeh, to be able to call out in praise of God, where each angel listens to the other and as unison calls out to God. It's a model of David HaMelech that the Mishnah tells us that David HaMelech learned from Achitophel only one thing, and he called him his teacher, Rabo Alufo Miyuda'o. This is the model. You learn something from somebody, you show them a tremendous amount of respect. And the Munati Techa quote that stayed in the Gemara, that the people in Bavel, the rabbis in Bavel, would stand up one for each other because they learned one from each other. But it goes much deeper than this. And this is what we alluded to earlier in the writings of Reb Leibowitz, where he says that it's brought down from the Talmidei HaBesh, the students of Baal Shem Tov, that every Jew has a point in him that makes him Yeshbo Nekudah Chashuva Shemiyuchad Ba Mikol B'nei Doro, that makes him unique from everyone in the generation. And even what we would seem to be like the lowliest type of person has this Nekudah, has this point that even the greatest people don't have, and that's why he's created. Because v'chol nivra yesh bo tzarech miyuchad pertei hashayach dafka lo, that everyone has something specific to him, and that's why the person is there, and that's why he says l'fizeh. Therefore, tarich kol achad, every person has to linhog kavod b'chaveiro, has to treat other people with respect, even if they seem to be lower than you, because you're respecting this aspect, if nothing else, of this importance that this person has, that they are brought into this world. And this is what we need to focus in on in the times of Sfira Saomer, that we have to recognize this quality that every single person has that makes every person unique. This is the first major lesson that the Medrash is teaching us, that we need to try to work within ourselves, to inculcate within ourselves the lesson of being able to seek advice. On one level, to be able to seek advice from rabbanim, from rabbis, from elders, who are able to give us das Torah, the view of Torah, and to be able to tell us this is the correct behavior, this is not the correct behavior. Not what's based on our mindset, but this is based and rooted in what Torah is demanding from us. And there's a secondary aspect of not only seeking advice from rabbis and great people, but to be able to seek advice from one another. Not to have this ego that says I'm always right, but to be able to listen to the advice of somebody. That Nazar and Avihu, not only did they not listen to advice of Moshe and Aaron, they didn't consult each other. And that's also a problem. That life is about being able to be machnia. There's a certain humility. The ability to be a cup and not always to be the bottle. That you have the ability to be able to take what other people have to say and to be able to respect that aspect. That every single person has a purpose in this world. Every person has a value in this world. And therefore I can come to respect everybody. And there's an aspect about everyone from whom I can learn and that I can be a cup ready to be filled from everyone around me, that everyone has something so special to give to me, and therefore everyone needs to be treated with respect, which is the whole point of Sfira Saomer. That's level number one. The second level of the Medrash, of the this time is to atone for the sale of Yosef as well as for the sin of the golden calf, is developed in the Shemi Shmuel. The Shemi Shmuel explains that throughout Vayikra and elsewhere in the Torah, the Mishkan is referred to as the Ohel Moed, which is usually translated as the Tent of Meeting. It was the place where the whole of Jewish people assembled to perform the communal spiritual duties. Once the Mishkan was constructed, private altars for animals, sacrifices were forbidden. This was going to be the spiritual center. This, he explains, as always, reflected a spiritual reality as well as a physical law. The existence of the Mishkan as a single focus of the nation meant that they too had reached a level at which they achieved real theological unity. They were the chosen nation of God, truly connected with the divine. This was a meeting in both physical and spiritual terms, which is the Ohel Moed represented. And he continues to explain that the mystics understand that Joseph was a person of unique character. His specialty, as it were, was to gather all of the spiritual contributions of the other members of the family and direct them toward God. And this is reflected by the fact that it gathered all the food in Egypt and distributed as appropriate. He is known as the head, and just as the head is in control of the body, so too was Yosef the spiritual leader and controller of the others. It should be apparent that this character is similar to that expressed by the Almohad. And therefore, when the brothers sold Yosef, opposing the influence that Yosef could bring to this world, they exposed a defect in their ability to appreciate and utilize the power of gathering which he embodied. This defect, we may assume, was passed on to descendants and was still present in the national character of the Jewish people at the time of the construction of the temple and of the tabernacle. So before the divine presence could enter the Mishkan, enabling it to fulfill its intended function of communal unity and singularity of purpose, this national character flaw had to be expunged. Thus the people were required to bring a male goat to atone for the sale of Yosef at the inauguration ceremony. The second answer is also a very deep answer, and that is that the Medrash is saying that the problem that the Jewish people had, and it was a problem that followed them throughout, was a problem of lack of unity, of lack of appreciation of the importance of coming together. The sale of Yosef on a much deeper level was saying is we were trying to rid that aspect that would be able to unify all the brothers together. The Yosef from the word Asaf, to gather together, to make them whole, make them one. The Yosef which is connected with the city of Shechem, which is the heart of the land of Israel, to connect all elements together. And therefore, before we could have God coming down at the Ohel Moed, the place of meeting, the place, the central aspect of unity, so therefore that aspect had to be atoned for, and then and only then could God's presence come down. The Shem Shmuel continues very interestingly and notes that this will help us understand another related issue. The sad story of the 10 martyrs is well known. We read about it in the Musaf prayer of Yom Kippur, and we read about it on Tisha B'Av. 10 of the greatest sages in Jewish history were cruelly murdered by the Romans to atone for the sale of Yosef. We acknowledge that in some way these 10 martyrs lost their lives as an atonement for the sin of the 10 brothers who had sold Yosef centuries earlier. And obviously it's a complex issue, but he says, why did this happen at the time of the Roman domination of Israel? Why was this punishment not executed at an earlier time? Why at the end of the Second Temple period? He says, perhaps, continues the Shem Shmuel, we may suggest that while the Mishkan and later its replacement, the Temple, stood, the forces that united the Jewish people were in operation. As we have seen, the primary function of the Almohad was to link and unite the people. Thus the traces remaining of the sale of Yosef could not exert themselves, as the opposite force was too strong. However, toward the end of the Second Temple period, when Basil's hatred was rife among Jews, indeed it was ultimately destroyed for this evil. This expressed a fundamental lack of unity, enabling the remaining vestiges of the sale to reassert themselves and to demand, as it were, a price, which is the 10 martyrs. And he concludes this essay by saying, we have proposed that Basil's hatred causes disunity. Actually, this could happen the reverse. For when there's no unifying force among the members of the Jewish people, this causes an increase in senseless hatred. Both views are true. For the sad situation is in fact a vicious cycle. Hatred causes disunity, which in turn courts more hatred. And this is the problem that we need to work on until today, where we need to have this unifying aspect which will take out all of this negativity and this negative feelings of disunity among the people. The prayer for the return of the Beis HaMikdash, of the temple, is not just a return for a physical building. It's a return for something much deeper than that. It's a return for the unity of the Jewish people. It's a return to a state, really, of Yosef, a state where the entire people can come together in a unifying force where there is a tremendous amount of love among the people. If we understand this to be the the essence of what the Olmoed, the Mishkan, is about is a unifying factor, and therefore there needed to be an atonement for the times where we show this lack of unity, the sale of Yosef, as well as the time of the Chet HaEgel, the time of the golden calf, when the people were split among the people who desired to build the calf. We can understand now as well the punishment of Nadav and Avihu. When the fire came down, there was a tremendous excitement among the people. There was an intensity among the people. And what does Nadav and Avihu do? What do they do? They take fire and they offer it up to God. And as Chizkuni points out, and we saw this many years ago, that says the Chizkuni, Vayasimu Aleh Ketoret Mishalahem, they took of their own. The Chol Ketoret Cheina Mishal Sibur Nikra'et Zara. Any incense offering that's not brought on behalf of the people is a strange offering. What was the sin of Nadav and Avihu? The sin of Nadav and Avihu was this very sin. That at the time of Jewish unity, when the entire people are coming down and showing their tremendous joy in God's presence, Nadav and Avihu separate themselves and they offer a sacrifice to God from themselves and not from the people. And this is the problem. The problem is at the very moment of unity, what you need to do is to express it on a level of unity and not on a personal level. And this is further reflected in the Medrash, where they don't even consult each other, where each one is really working on an individual level. This is the very antithesis of what the temple stood for. The temple and God's presence is meant to be found among the people. Judaism is very much a community-oriented religion. I think that both of these answers, the importance of seeking advice, particularly from elders, the importance of unity, of bringing the Jewish people together, are both summed up so beautifully in the Nesiva Shalom and the Slomin HaRebbe. This is the final idea I'd like to work through now. The Nesiva Shalom says that a person should always be connected to God. And if a person's connected to God, so he'll have a Shmira Elyona, he'll have a certain divine guarding and watching over this person. But continues the Siva Shalom, afilu im hu ba'atzmo eino davuk ba'Hashem yitbarach. It's very hard to be really connected to God and to be on this level of the Shmira Elyona, of this tremendous being guarded by God. He says the following, afilu im hu ba'atzmo eino davuk ba'Hashem yitbarach, aval hu davuk liyudi shedavuk ba'Hashem yitbarach. A person may himself not be connected to God, but he's connected to somebody who is connected to God. Or he's connected to the community who are connected to God. Then yesh az gam alava tashmira hal yonach chofefet al dvekim b'rashay adad dvekim b'Hashem Yitbarach. Then this person can enjoy this special watching as well. And this is the importance of always being around people who are great people, and to be around the community as a whole, because you're not only connecting yourself to the advice of these people, not only connecting yourself to the unity of these people, but the great benefits that these people have, the presence of these people, will be able to go on this person as well. And this is why the Nesiva Shalom says so beautifully. He says this aspect of being able to connect yourself helps us to explain the aspect of Nadav and Avihu. And he says that Nadav and Avihu were unable, as we spoke about, to seek the advice of Moshe and Aaron. They were unable to be able to be nichna, to humble themselves to the advice of Moshe and Aaron and be connected to them. But he goes one step further. He says the fact that the rabbis tell us that they didn't get married and didn't have children, he says just like there's an aspect of being able to accept from somebody else. As we spoke about the bottle and the cup imagery, he says, "Kach yesh inyan hitkashrut shel hamashpil hamekabel." There's also an aspect of being able to give and having others receive. Nadav and Avihu were missing this as well. By not getting married, by not having children, they were unable even to give to others. They were lacking, although they were these great tzaddikim, they were lacking this ability to be connected. They didn't get married. They didn't connect themselves by giving to others. And we find this further in the fact that they didn't ask advice one from another. They lacked this aspect. Lo hayu mikusharim. They weren't connected. V'im kein, and because they weren't connected, not to Moshe and Aaron, not to great people, not even to themselves, not to what we would call the mini community, not to wives and children. V'im kein hayu chaserim et hashmira al yona v'nichshelu b'chol achatim elu. Therefore, they lacked having the special providence, and therefore fell into these difficulties that they fell into. And this, says in Nesivos Shalom, is one of the lessons that the Parsha of Nadav and Avihu is trying to teach us. That Yehudi tzarich liyot davuk b'Hashem, Jew has to be attached to God. V'af imhu atzmo eino davuk b'Hashem, and even if he can't personally, yitabek l'mishu davuk l'Hashem yitarach, you have to connect yourself to one who is connected, l'tzadik, to a righteous person, or to a group of people who have this fear of God, this awe of God. And I think this is the message that the Medrash is trying to teach us. As we begin with, Medrash is couched in terms that are not only explaining the text, but are real terms of Jewish philosophy and lessons for our lives. When the Medrash says, as Ramban notes, that the Jewish people had to bring more sacrifices to atone for the sin of the sale of Yosef and to atone for the sin of the golden calf before they're able to have the consecration of the tabernacle. This is a lesson not only about the Jewish people then, but a lesson for our lives as well. What are the key components to have God's presence rest in our own tabernacles? To have, in the language of Nesivos Shalom, the Shmira Elyona, this divine presence watching over us, guarding us, have an extra set of protection. What is that key component in life? So the Medrash is coming to teach us the two key components. One is the ability to listen to advice of older people, of rabbis, that when we make decisions in life, that we shouldn't say, well, you know, I've decided, I've thought it through, I know. A, it's important to ask the advice of peers, that everyone has something to offer and can give us an insight and a perspective that we ourselves may not know. But more importantly, it's important to ask advice of rabbis, of great people of Torah, who have that sense, who have that inner insight of, get a less expensive esrog, buy your wife a dress, have this insight of what life is about, of seeing a larger picture that perhaps in our own fervor that we lack, in our own limited mindset, we don't have that clarity of vision. And the second aspect, to have that Shmir El Yonah, to have this great protection, the Medrash is telling us, is to atone for the sin of the sale of Yosef, which is the sin of lack of unity. That the prerequisite for God's presence to come down among the people is to have a unified whole, is to have an entire Jewish people connected. And that if we want to have the Shmir El Yonah, this special divine protection, we need to connect ourselves and be around people who are great people, who are connected to God, to plug into the electric current in that indirect way, but we still benefit from the electricity, as well as to connect ourselves with the community at large, to try to be involved as much as possible in unity and not in disunity, that we're able to gain benefit from the special protection that God has over the people in general, that by connecting ourselves to great people and connecting ourselves to the community, we too benefit with this imagery of God's presence coming down and being able to enjoy that special relationship, that special presence.